According to the industry trade group Airlines for America, Sunday will be the busiest day of the Thanksgiving break, with nearly 2.9 million people taking to the skies. Thanksgiving Eve is expected to be the second busiest day for flyers. The organization attributes the rise in travelers to cheaper flights. Doug Kidd is the executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers, a nonpartisan passenger rights group that's based in Virginia. Doug, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we are going to have some busy airports this Thanksgiving weekend. Where are these cheaper flights coming from? Cheaper flights are said to be a big factor. Why are prices low?
Well, number one, the main reason why prices are low, and we have to distinguish that not all the seats are going to be sold at a low price. There are going to the airlines typically segregate the seats they have into what they call fare buckets. So there'll be some flights, some seats at a high price, some at a moderate price, and a few seats at a low price. If you're lucky enough to get those low seats, you know, well and good. Otherwise, you may find yourself wondering where those low-price seats are.
It's probably too late to do anything this year, but perhaps for next Thanksgiving, when are the best days to fly out and come home?
We recommend that you not try to fly out exactly, say, on a Wednesday and come back on a Sunday. But if you can, come fly out, say, on Monday and come back on a Monday. Because while everybody's trying to fly Sunday, that next day, Monday, is going to be a lot easier to get a low-price ticket on, and you'll be a lot less stressed if you can manage that.
How about Thanksgiving Day itself?
Sometimes that works as well, because, you know, everybody's flying on Wednesday, and you can find that, you know, sometimes Thursday itself, Thursday morning, all the traffic's gone, and you can sometimes have a better time of it. But it depends from airport to airport and destination to destination.
Well, let's get inside the airports now. For people boarding in the days to come, what's the most common mistakes people should avoid to ensure their experience goes as smoothly as possible?
Well, I would say that the most common mistake is trying to pack too much with you as carry-on. The flights are going to be full, and while they've put more seats in the airplanes, they haven't necessarily expanded the amount of carry-on capacity. So you may find yourself, you know, in the boarding process with your, you know, carry-on case, and you know, the airline will say, "I'm sorry, folks, we're out of space on the overhead bins. You know, your bag's going to have to be checked at the gate and fly with the checked baggage," which is actually not such a bad deal because they do not charge you the checked baggage fee. But if the plane is delayed or any number of things that can happen, you want to have a small bag that you can put under the seat with your necessities in case the plane is delayed or in case the flight is canceled midway through your trip, say at a hub or whatever, while you're changing planes to your destination. Having that small bag with your necessities can make a big difference.
Oh, so even though if you pack like you are just packing with a carry-on and everything is with you, always keep in your mind that your bag could easily have to be checked, and you don't have a choice about that.
Exactly right.
So another tip you sent to us is to bring small snacks, small treats for ourselves and our kids, but avoid cheese snacks. And you know, you realize you're in Wisconsin here, so you're going to have to tread carefully, Doug.
Well, I'm afraid that's the TSA's fault, not mine, or rather the fault of their equipment. Apparently cheese looks the same as an explosive, or the TSA's equipment has not gotten to the point yet where it can distinguish between the two. And the same, it's not...
You're serious here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not just cheese. Any organic material... one time I was traveling, I'd bought a couple of loaves of, you know, I think one was banana bread and one was pumpkin bread from one of these farmers markets. Well, that got the TSA's attention right away. You know, they had to stop, they had to open up the bag and they'd take away, "What's this?" And, you know, it was resolved in a few minutes, but, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, just kind of slowed things down and, you know, got me the attention that I didn't really want or need at that particular time.
So on this discussion of snacks, what would you recommend?
you know, hard candy like Lifesavers or Jolly Ranchers or something like that.
Oh, yeah, sugar them up. Thanks, Doug.
Well, you use that sparingly.
Carry on.
Yeah, you put that in your purse or your small carry-on bag. A little bit of gum especially can help when the plane's going up and down and you have the pressure changes on the ear. You know, that can make a big difference for the children. You know, they get bored or whatever, okay. You know, here's a little treat for you. Settles them down a little bit.
What do you think of empty water bottles and then filling them up on the other side of security?
That's a trick I hadn't heard before.
Because I know when I'm flying, I find that more and more airports are now offering filtered water at the water fountains. And so we've been carrying, and my kids do too, they carry their empty water bottle. And then once we get on the other side of security, then they go and find the nearest one and fill up their water with cold water.
Well, certainly that's an effective maneuver, especially since the price of bottled water on the other side of security can sometimes be a lot more than a lot of people would like to pay.
What are some other tips that are going to be little tips and tricks to help get through the airport crowds? Because it can just get packed at gates. You're trying to maneuver to get to your gate, and there are so many people, so many bags at Thanksgiving.
That's right. As I said, if you can carry a smaller bag rather than a larger rolling bag, that's going to make things a lot easier for you, especially when you board. Wear comfortable clothing. Wear sneakers instead of, say, dress shoes. Anything that's going to make you comfortable, because the day could be a long day. You're going to start off. There's going to be a likelihood of delays. All it takes is one plane to have a problem, and then that delay will cascade through the system. The other thing is that you want to be well rested before you even get to the airport. So don't spend the night before packing. Make sure that you can get a good night's sleep. And the other thing is that with regard to the bags that you do have, make sure that you've got address and contact information on the inside of the bag, in case in the baggage handling process your tags get ripped off, and this happens from time to time, and they say, okay, whose bag is this? Well, if there's contact information and destination information inside the bag, and they will look, that bag can find its way to you.
We're talking right now with Doug Kidd. He is the executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. That's a nonpartisan passenger rights organization based in Virginia. Talking about how to navigate the airports during this Thanksgiving holiday, and also how to get the best way to be able to make it to your destination and stay sane along the way. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Will you be flying over Thanksgiving? What are your tips in flying during the holidays when there are crowds and there is a rush? Do you have some tips and tricks? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug, what about electronic devices? How should we mind our electronic devices?
Well, right now, electronic devices are okay. You want to make sure they're charged up, of course, before you get to the airport, because you'll find that there are a lot of people there, are going to use whatever facilities, because their devices are not charged up. So you want to make sure yours are charged. There's no problem right now going through security, although the people at security do insist that you put them separately into a bin so they can be scanned. I recommend those things, especially for children, because it keeps them distracted. It's a long flight. No matter how short it is, it's going to be a long flight.
And going through security, shoes on, Doug, shoes off, who does what?
Going through security, they're going to tell you what they want you to do.
Okay.
They'll say, put your shoes on. You can go through with your shoes on. Sometimes they'll require the shoes to be taken off.
It depends on the airport.
It is going to depend on the airport, and it's going to depend on the screening equipment. For example, if you're going through, say, a smaller airport where they don't have a body scanner, you're going to go through the standard metal detector. Sometimes they ask you to take your shoes off there, sometimes not. You know, some shoes have a metal shank in the sole, and that will tend to set off the metal detector. And it's going to be strictly up to the individual airport what they're going to ask you to do.
Doug Kidd is with us talking air travel this hour. He's executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. You can join in with your questions and insights on air travel. 800-642-1234. Will you be flying over Thanksgiving? In which areas do you think the airline industry is getting it right? Where is it largely failing? Join in. 800-642-1234. We'll return after this news update.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
Yeah, sounds so lovely. Air travel is this maze of always evolving security procedures, more and more restrictive economy fares that may prohibit you from sitting with family members, and other unexpected surprises along the flying journey. With the backdrop of a strong economy and solid consumer confidence, AAA expects Americans to get on the road and trek through airports over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend in the largest numbers in a dozen years. Doug Kidd stays with us. He's executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. Your questions on air travel, 800-642-1234. Do passengers need a Bill of Rights? Would you welcome your data being collected by airlines to offer better, more personalized service? Or do you find that disturbing? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Paul in Milwaukee. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment, really. Last time I flew, I took a jar of peanut butter with me on my carry-on, and the TSA agent said that technically that's a paste, and all pastes are banned, and he wouldn't let me take it through. So just a tip for everybody there to not take peanut butter with you on your carry-on.
Doug Kidd, what's the lowdown on peanut butter?
Well, it's not just peanut butter. It's any kind of liquid or gel that the TSA finds troubling. So their attitude is that they don't want any liquids or gel with you at the as you go through security. But of course the curious thing is if you can find peanut butter or gels or any kind of liquids on the other side of security, then it's okay. We would think that by this point,
so TSA peanut butter is a gel. It's a paste. Are we parsing words here? Is gel and paste? I don't get it.
Well, the problem is that the TSA's equipment simply cannot discriminate between peanut butter and explosives. So they said, okay. And the same thing with any other kind of liquid. They can't distinguish between water and, say, nitroglycerin. So they simply ban everything.
I see. Well, Paul, thank you so much for the heads up. Let's go to Carol in Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to ask your guest about traveling. I'm visually impaired, and a number of years ago I traveled on my own and had set up assistance with the airline ahead of time. And on the trip, I was not given all the assistance I was promised. But when I got to an airport to change planes, after I was about 50 feet from the plane, I was abandoned, and I had to fend for myself when I don't have enough vision to read the signs to figure out which way to go. And I had to—I did get out of it by asking for help, but it was a long, frustrating process.
Doug.
Yeah, I'm really kind of surprised at that. But one of the things you can ask for, and what I would recommend that if you're flying again, is ask for wheelchair assistance to take you from the flight to your to the flight that you're transferring to. And that's not anything that you should have to pay extra for, and they will bring and provide you with that service. It's not provided by the airline; it's provided by the airport.
I see. Carol, thank you so much for calling in. Doug, earlier this year, there was a lot of media attention on flights that were overbooked and passengers being asked to get off. We haven't heard much of that since the spring when the physician was forcibly removed from a United flight from Chicago to Louisville. How big of an issue is this?
It's become far less of an issue since that particular incident, because the airlines have recognized that there is a problem, and they're dealing with that problem now at the gate level, and they've put in place procedures to keep that sort of problem where crew arrives at the last minute and needs to fly, you know, from point A to point B. So they've put in place some things to keep that sort of thing from happening. But in some places and under some conditions, the airlines are still overbooking flights simply because they don't want to fly an empty seat. And they have very good records and very good ways of predicting, you know, how full a flight is going to be. Nevertheless, you know, from time to time, even the best laid plans of mice and men go astray, and there are going to be more people showing up to fly than there are seats available. But again, they're taking care of that at the gate level rather than, you know, loading the plane up and then saying, oh my gosh, we got too many people. So it hasn't been such a problem as it was in the past, or in the case of Dr. Dow.
How do you suggest that airlines manage the overbooking issue?
We would like to see the airlines adopt a little bit different policies, where if you have a plane that has 100 seats, then that's the total number of confirmed reservations that they can sell. Now, if they want to overbook the flight, fine. They can, you know, they should sell their overbooked flights as standby tickets and say to people, look, you know, we know from past experience an overbooked flight will always have a few extra seats available. We're going to sell these extra seats on a standby basis, but you should know that if everybody shows up, you won't be able to fly. That way people know, you know, what they're getting. The confirmed reservation actually means a confirmed reservation for a seat that actually exists on the plane, rather than, you know, getting to the airport and saying, yeah, I've got a confirmed reservation. They say, I'm sorry, the flight's full. You're going to have to, you know, we're going to bump you, and here's a voucher or whatever.
And how common is flying standby today? Is that still very popular?
Standby is not as popular or as available as it once was. What the airlines will do is charge you an extra fee, say you get to the airport early, and, you know, your flight may be at 12, but let's say there's a flight going out at 11, and you may say, okay, I'm here, I'm ready to fly. If you can get me on the 11 o'clock flight, you know, so much the better. And, you know, they'll charge you an extra fee to do that. But whether that's, you know, meets up with your plans, you know, that's going to be up to you.
And so what about accommodating people? Let's navigate this world of vouchers. How, if you are inconvenienced, what should you be asking for? What fine print should you be reading, and what should you be aware of?
Right. The FAA actually has rules stating how much you can be compensated by the airlines, or how much you should be compensated by the airlines in the event that you are bumped. And the minimum, I think, is $400, and it goes up to $1,350. Of course, you want to always ask for as much as you can possibly get. And, you know, it's preferable to get that in the form of a check rather than a voucher for future flights, because, you know, you never know whether you're going to be flying again to the destination that the airline wants you to fly to. So that's something that I kind of, you know, as when I travel, I don't mind being bumped. I'm glad to get the voucher, but if you're traveling for family or business obligations, being bumped can be really inconvenient.
And so what about when the gate agent calls for people to get off the flight, you know, before boarding, and saying, you know, here are your incentives. We will give you X, Y, and Z. What should be standing out to you as you listen to this announcement?
Well, you know, you don't. It's going to be up to you and exactly how flexible you really are in your plans. Now, for some people, you know, a voucher is not going to help them any if they've got a connecting flight to their next destination, to their final destination, and that flight that they're connecting to is going to be the last flight of the day.
Mm.
So be very careful in terms of volunteering. If it's the last flight of the day and you're going to be overnighting at the airport, that's not going to be a very good value.
If you're just joining us, we're with Doug Kidd. He is the executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. That's a nonpartisan passenger rights group based in Virginia. Talking about air travel this holiday season, will you be flying over Thanksgiving? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. In what areas do you think the airline industry is doing a good job? Where is it falling short? Where does it have to improve? What about data and your data being collected to offer better, more personalized service? Does that disturb you? Do you find that okay? What questions or concerns or praises do you have about flying? Join in 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug, a Democratic congressman from Minnesota introduced what he called the Airline Passenger Bill of Rights. It would require airlines to provide passengers with a one-page document that details its policies related to involuntary bumping, to lost or damaged baggage, compensation for flight cancellations or delays, and what happens when a traveler is disabled or injured. Is this Bill of Rights something we need?
Yes and no. First of all, there's a lot of existing regulations and rules that are out there already. What we would like about this proposal is that they want to put this up front on a one-page piece of paper where anyone can say, okay, you know, what are my rights, what are my responsibilities, and so forth. And a lot of that can fit on one page, but if you, whenever anyone flies, they are agreeing to abide by the airline's contract of carriage that the airline has written. And if you ever take a look at those contracts of carriage, they can extend for 30, 40, 50 pages or more, and they're all small print. So, yeah, there's definitely a need for something to be open and upfront and say, you know, okay, these are the most common things that we want to, you know, get out in the open that says, you know, this is your rights, these are your responsibilities, and so forth. So it's a good idea, but, you know, people should be aware of that there's going to be a lot more that can fit on one page.
Would this one page make any difference in the passenger experience on these airlines?
Well, now, that's a good question, too, because you can write rules and regulations all you want, but rules and regulations are carried out by people. And sometimes, you know, the airline employees, they're human beings too, and especially the flight attendants. And here I have to say that one of the big issues with the flight attendants is that they're not getting enough rest. And they're also being asked to do a lot more nowadays on full flights than they were used to doing on a flight that, say, was half full. So if you have flight attendants who are being, in effect, overworked, not getting enough rest, you know, that can be a cause of friction, when you have a full flight and passengers themselves are kind of tired and irritable and they want to get to their flight, their destinations. And so it's kind of like a Murphy's Law effect. You know, if you have a very tired passenger who's, not in a particularly good mood, chances are they're going to come up against a flight attendant who also may be tired and not in a very good mood. So you want to avoid those kind of situations.
What about pilots and the crew up front? Are those rest periods being enforced? Are they highly enforced?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. And, in fact, the pilots get more rest time than the flight attendants. And that's kind of a sore point with the flight attendants.
So when you look at these contracts of carriage from airline to airline, are they relatively similar? Are the rules and regulations that each airline has in getting you from point A to point B, do they cut across most airlines?
The contracts of carriage are generally similar in terms of what they in what they say. And basically what they're doing is they're saying, okay, we have, you know, we the airlines have all the options. You, the passenger, have very few choices. So one of the things that's kind of surprising when you look at a contract of carriage, you'll find that the airline schedule is not guaranteed. Your seat is, and your particular seat in the airplane, that's not guaranteed either. What they're doing is they're saying, we're selling you passage. The schedule's not guaranteed. Your seat's not guaranteed. We'll get you there when we get you there. Generally, they're going to get you there reasonably on time and in the seat that they've assigned to you. But they're not making any promises, and they're saying that's not part of the contract.
It seems a lot, if you will, is up in the air. Is there anything that is guaranteed?
About the only thing guaranteed is that if for whatever reason they find your behavior unacceptable, they can ask you to leave the plane.
How often does that happen?
From what we've heard, not that often. But again, there's been a change in the way airlines operate over the years. It used to be that when the airlines had more crew up front in the cockpit, that you could ask to talk to the captain or whatever. Nowadays, there's only two pilots up there, and they can't leave their controls. So the big thing now is that the cabin is now under the command of the flight attendants.
Mm-hmm.
And asking to talk to the cabin is something to the captain or the flight crew is something that actually can get you booted off the plane.
Let's talk about legroom for a moment. Where are we at in the economy class with legroom, and also changes to first class? What have you seen, and in business class?
I travel frequently, so I'm able to occasionally I'll be able to fly in the first class or business class. More often than not, I've traveled economy with everyone else. The airlines used to have a standard of 34 inches in legroom for economy class, and that's just barely adequate for someone of average height or a little bit above. What the airlines have done is to say, okay, we can take away 3 inches of legroom from, say, 10 rows of people. We can put an extra row in. That three extra inches of legroom that you're sacrificing can make all the difference in the world on a medium or long flight. And for someone who's taller, it can become really quite intolerable. But that's the way the airlines are going, and in some cases they want to get it to be even less than 30 inches. They're pressuring the seat manufacturers to reduce the amount of cushioning on the seats so that they can squeeze still more rows of seats onto a given airplane. But of course, squeezing more rows onto an airplane doesn't increase the amount of overhead bin space. Mm-hmm. So you have a situation developed where, okay, people can load up. You can get the people on board, yes, but the people who are boarding last may not have any space for their overhead in the overhead compartments, and they have to gate check their bags.
What about seats that go completely flat? We've heard about this coming in both business class, perhaps, but also first class of seats that you can almost, I guess it would be more of a bed-like situation.
Right. I've actually had the opportunity to fly on a couple of those. Recently, I traveled to Japan, which is a 14-hour flight, and I'd have been able to save up enough points so that I was able to upgrade to these lie-flat seats. They do indeed lie flat, but they are somewhat narrow. So they, so to say that it's bed-like, well, sort of. Don't try sleeping on your side. That's simply not going to work. But it does make a difference to be able to lay out flat if you're traveling. On an overseas flight or even cross country.
Doug Kidd is helping us navigate the Thanksgiving weekend in airports. He's executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Will you be flying over Thanksgiving? In what areas do you think the airline industry is getting it right? Where is it largely falling short? 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update.
Been on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
AAA projects that nearly 51 million Americans will travel at least 50 miles from home during the five-day period beginning tomorrow and running through Sunday. With 89% of people driving, almost 8% will fly. No major storms are forecast to snarl major airports between now and Thanksgiving morning. That raises the hope of a relatively delay-free start to the holiday travel period, though flyers should keep their eyes peeled for a few possible trouble spots. Weather aside, Doug Kidd is helping us to get a handle on the things we can control in air travel. He is Executive Director of the National Association of Airline Passengers based in Virginia. You can join in 800-642-1234. Would you welcome your data being collected to offer better, more personalized service at the ticket counter? Or do you find that quite disturbing? Do airline passengers need a Bill of Rights? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Camp Douglas. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. Let me see if I got this right. If there's 100 seats available on a flight and they sell all 100, they still book more seats in case people don't show up? Is that the way it works?
That's correct.
Why do they do that when they've already got their money for the capacity of the plane?
Well, they do that because people simply don't show up 100% of the time for 100% of the flights.
They still got their money, though, for 100 seats, so they're greedy is what they are.
Yes, indeed. They're in the business of making money.
Well, I hope they don't complain about the high cost of medical insurance and car insurance, so that's the way life is, I guess, huh?
Well, it actually makes a bit of sense. People want to travel, and it really doesn't make sense to fly an empty seat somewhere if there's somebody on the ground who says, hey, I'd like to go somewhere that plane is flying and it's got an empty seat. As a common carrier, they're kind of required to accommodate whoever shows up, for the travel. What they've done is they've said, okay, we know from experience that a certain number of people are not going to show up, so we can safely sell, say, 102, 103, or even 50% more seats because...
Even 50% more seats?
That's right. In its early days, I think one of the major airlines, Southwest, they had a situation where people simply weren't showing up, so they could sell 50% more seats than they actually were on the plane because people didn't show. So, okay, they were able to accommodate the people who did want to fly.
Are they still doing this?
I don't think so, but this was something that happened apparently early on in their history.
Well, Jim, thanks so much for calling in. Doug, we came across a news story yesterday about how airlines are using data about their passengers to provide individualized service. For instance, if they know your flight was delayed by 6 hours, they can personally apologize to you the next time you fly. Or if you're a frequent flyer and they know you like a certain wine on the plane, they'll make sure they have plenty in stock. The idea is to make you feel special so you're more likely to come back. How does that sit with you?
Well, certainly, in days gone by when passengers were fewer and the airlines were struggling to attract passengers, this sort of thing would be taken for granted. Nowadays, we're dealing in millions of passengers flying every day. So much of this is simply just plugged into a computer and they say, okay, we know what to expect. But collecting data on passengers is somewhat of a two-edged sword. It can be used to make your experience better or, in some cases, used to protect the airline in case an incident occurs. So we're somewhat ambivalent in terms of, how this data is going to be used and what data is actually being collected.
And we don't even know how the data, per se, would end up being used in the end?
Well, the airlines say it's going to be used to offer better service, but... As with anything else, the airlines can sometimes use this data for purposes that maybe are not necessarily in the passenger's best interest, but rather in the airline's best interest. So, again, it's not necessarily what the airlines are doing. It's what they could do with the data that makes us a little bit nervous.
Jim, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to John now in Madison. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Here's my question. It seems like these are fairly sophisticated systems that run the airline ticketing. And I've been a victim of having been on a plane and begging people to please give up their seats. If they sell these and they're overbooked, why can't they make sure that the people who purchase the seats first are guaranteed to be taking off in the air, and the people who were part of those who were were sold their tickets after the plane was already booked to capacity, why aren't they the ones who are asked to leave? And I'll take my response off the air. Thanks.
Go ahead, Doug.
That's a good question. And one of the issues that we have with the airlines and the FAA, because your guess is hit the your caller has hit the nail on the head. It's entirely possible for two people to buy their tickets on a flight, one early on at a low price, one later on at a high price. Well, guess which one the airline is going to bump? Well, they're going to bump the person who has the lowest fare this to maximize their revenue, and then they'll work things out with that person either in terms of a voucher or putting them on the next flight or whatever. That's not something that we think is appropriate. As I said, if the airline wants to sell more seats than there are on the airplane, fine. But it should be first come, first serve, and a confirmed reservation should mean a confirmed reservation for an actual seat. And a person coming to the airport who has bought their flight, their ticket, well in advance, should not find out when they get to the airport that they don't have a confirmed reservation, but they actually bought a standby seat, and the airline just simply didn't tell them that.
Let's go to Jake in Appleton. Go ahead, Jake.
Hi. I was wondering if the airlines ever plan to try to make the seating process more efficient. Boarding from the front of the plane always seems to create this impenetrable traffic jam, and I've heard that it's smarter to board from the back of the plane or the windows first.
Doug, go ahead.
Yeah, I've seen those studies, and you're quite right. It is more efficient to load the airplane, you know, from the back forward. Unfortunately, you know, that's not the way the airlines want to do things, mainly because they want to give their favorite passengers first crack at the overhead bins. Whereas if they board from the back, there are people who will say, okay, I'll just simply put my carry-on here in the first class so I don't have to drag it down the aisle. And so I think that's one of the factors that's involved. Now, there was a time when they would board not just from one entry port, but from two or even three simultaneously. But I think for whatever reasons, the airlines do things the way they do, and you know, people basically have to live with the consequences. That's why. And the airlines like this, too, because now they can say, okay, oh, you want to board first, we can assign you a higher priority for a fee.
There's a fee. There's always that catch. Jake, thank you so much for calling in. Doug, one concern your group has been raising has to do with the lack of planes that are equipped with suitable lavatories for passengers who are disabled. What's the holdup there?
There, the holdup is, I'm afraid, the industry. To put a accessible lavatory in an airplane, and these lavatories are already designed, they're ready to go, all the airline has to do is say, we want an accessible lavatory in our plane, and it's no big deal. It's not any more expensive to have an accessible lavatory than one that is, you know, the tiny ones that they already have. The big thing is that, of course, if you have one of these accessible lavatories, you have to sacrifice three seats, and the airlines don't want to do that. But from our point of view, any one of us can become disabled overnight, you know, through accident, injury, illness, or even just age. And so accessible lavatories, from our point of view, are not just for people who are disabled. It's for people who might become disabled in the future, and that's any one of us. So this is something we would like to see. Now, at a recent conference in Washington, D.C., I was there, and I asked some of the people who were in wheelchairs. I said, well, okay, you're going to fly. It's a long flight. What do you do? And they said, well, they simply didn't eat or drink the day before, and that's how they dealt with not being able to use a restroom on the plane for an extended flight.
Where's the regulation here? Shouldn't there be laws that need to be followed requiring handicap-accessible lavatories on planes?
The FAA has put out their own regulations trying to implement these laws, but in the most recent conference they said, okay, this is going to be for new aircraft, that is to say, aircraft that have not yet been designed and are not yet on the drawing board, and not for the airplanes that are already out there. Personally, we would like to see Congress step up to the plate on this and say and mandate accessible laboratories on all larger aircraft. That is to say, your aircraft where you have six across seating and are used for flights of more than a couple of hours.
Well, in the minute or so we have left with you, how hopeful are you that the various changes that you're calling for with regard to air travel will actually see the light of day, be granted in the not-too-distant future?
Well, we are hopeful simply because if enough people are concerned and put pressure on Congress and on the FAA, Congress and the FAA will act. A few years back, there was a big deal about using your electronic devices during takeoff. Well, there was enough pressure that FAA convened a rulemaking committee, and they changed the rules. The same thing can happen in any number of other areas, whether it's amount of legroom on a flight, accessible laboratories, or any other things that make the difference between a good flight that can be enjoyed and a flight that has to be endured.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for joining us and helping us navigate air travel here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Doug Kidd is the executive director of the National Association of Airline Passengers. That's a nonpartisan air passenger rights organization that is based in Virginia. This hour of the morning show was produced by Bill Martins and Niaja Ellison. We had technical direction from executive director Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us. On Your Money is coming up next.